It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And if we're to take the anonymous op-ed at its word, then we are to believe that there are two tracks within the White House: what the president wants, his message, and what senior Trump officials want and what they're working on, sometimes under the radar and sometimes against the president's word, to get. Well, right now we're seeing one of those dynamics play out in the area of sanctions and human rights. Up until now, the Trump administration has been soft on human rights issues, especially when it comes to his favored trade partners in the East, like China. But this week, some in Congress and those high up in the administration are pushing the president to put sanctions on China, not because of trade, but to punish China for the detention of hundreds of thousands of ethnic Uyghurs and other minority Muslims in large internment camps. Now, when we're talking about large internment camps, on Sunday, Human Rights Watch released a detailed report that concluded that the violations are of a, quote, scope and scale not seen in China since the 1966 Cultural Revolution, in other words, the worst of Mao. And with me now to talk about both parts of this story, what's going on in China and the potential U.S. involvement in an age of Trump, are Chris Buckley. He's a China correspondent for the New York Times. And this past weekend, he came out with an investigation into the detention of Uyghurs in China. And with him, we have Josh Rogan, global opinions columnist who covers foreign policy and national security for The Washington Post. So Chris Buckley in China, Josh Rogan in Washington, thanks for coming on WNYC today. Hi.
Thank you.
Thanks for covering this important issue.
Chris, in China, I'd like to start with a history lesson for our listeners, because I would say this is not on the average listener's radar. So what's the history of the Uyghur population in China and their relationship with the communist Chinese government?
The Uyghurs are the Muslim minority whose homeland is Xinjiang province, which is now part of the People's Republic of China. Now, unlike the vast majority of Chinese citizens, Uyghurs are of Turkic origin, and by and large, they're Muslim as well. So culturally, linguistically, in terms of their tradition and lifestyle, they're very different from the great majority of Han Chinese people. And so that's been a point of tension with China even before the formation of the People's Republic of China. And it's been a particular point of tension in the past few years because in the Chinese government's viewpoint, Uyghurs have become a source of, as the Chinese government puts it, of extremism, religious radicalism, and also attempts to separate from the Chinese government. So what we've been seeing, especially since major riots in the regional capital of Xinjiang in 2009, is a ratcheting up of pressure there. And that's grown sharply in the past couple of years with the emergence of these internment and indoctrination programs.
And at the center of the crackdown are these re-education or internment centers that the Chinese government says don't even exist. But according to your reporting, there are hundreds of them in Western China, and you describe them as places where Uyghurs spend their days in high-pressure indoctrination programs, where they are forced to listen to lectures, sing hymns praising the Chinese Communist Party, and write self-criticism essays. How much is this reminiscent of what I call before the worst of Mao, and how do they get out of these internment programs?
Well, there's certainly echoes of how China's operated in the past and the kind of re-education and indoctrination programs that prevailed under Mao, the anti-rightist campaign, then the waves of indoctrination during the Cultural Revolution. But these policies in particular have more recent origins as well. In Chinese, these camps are usually called transformation through education camps. And that's a term that has drawn its inspiration from policies and programs that the Chinese government instituted from the 1990s to deal with cults. So in other words, they're using the same policies and practices that they use, for example, against adherents of the Falun Gong movement. now against this much larger population of Muslim Uyghurs.
And they're supposed to renounce their faith in Islam?
I think it's more complicated than that. And it's certainly a very mixed picture that you get from interviewing Uyghurs who have had experience in camps. I think the general message is that they have to renounce any public adherence to their religion, and exceedingly narrow limits are put on where and how they can demonstrate the Islamic faith. So in other words, it's not usually the case that Uyghurs are expected to out and out renounce Islam, but there's very strict conditions put on. For example, you can only pray in a mosque if you have permission to be there. You can pray at home, but not if there are guests or friends present, and so on. So there's all of these rules, as well as, all of these restrictions, for example, on wearing headscarves if you're a woman, or any other signs of Islamic faith in public.
We can take a few phone calls, listeners, for Chris Buckley and Josh Rogan. I wonder if we have any Uyghur Muslims listening, any of you who may be in the New York area or anywhere within the sound of my voice today. Feel free to tell your story and that of anyone you know in China at the moment. 212-433-WNYC, or anyone else with a personal connection to this story. 212-433-9692, as we pivot now to how the world is responding, particularly the United States, but also the United Nations, with Josh Rogan, global opinions columnist who covers foreign affairs for The Washington Post. Josh, I see last month the UN conducted a meeting on the issue. A UN panel confronted Chinese diplomats on the issue. How did the diplomats respond, seeing as their government denies that the situation even exists?
Right. Well, there's been a slow but steady uptick in interest in Chinese repression in Xinjiang, both in Washington and at the United Nations, pushed by certain officials from certain countries and certain lawmakers who are passionate about this issue. But largely, it must be said that the world has reacted with silence. And there has been a resistance to real international condemnation, much less steps that would force the Chinese government to first be more transparent about what's going on in the internment camps, and second, to perhaps not commit the mass repression that's ongoing today. At the UN, the Trump administration has an ambassador named Kelly Curry, who's been very passionate about this. She testified to the Congressional Executive Commission on China last month that the Chinese government is attempting to, quote, Sinicize religion and transform religion and ethnicity in Chinese society in a scheme more ambitious than the Cultural Revolution. She said the scope of this campaign is breathtaking, right? More recently, the new head of the UN Human Rights Commission has called on China to allow international inspectors to the camps. The Chinese reaction at first was to deny that they exist, then presented with incontrovertible evidence that it exists, which is everywhere, satellite photos, you name it. They switched to insisting that this was a matter of Chinese national sovereignty and that any international comment or inspection was an infringement on that sovereignty. Of course, that's what they say every time they're accused credibly of human rights violations. And, you know, if we were to go by that, then we would just the world would just be out of the human rights advocacy business altogether. So what we're all waiting for is to see if the UN or the United States government or Congress, for that matter, will take any actual punitive steps that might raise the pressure and the cost on China and the Chinese government to be more transparent about what's going on. Meanwhile, anecdotal accounts continue to emerge because of the great reporting by Chris and a few others, and it's a scary picture. There's just no doubt. Keep in mind that these internment camps, I think it must be said, are just the latest in a long series of increasingly repressive practices that are directed at Uyghurs and other Muslims and other ethnic minorities in Xinjiang, but also all over China, including in Tibet and other places. And this includes a massive state-controlled surveillance machine that uses all sorts of intrusive methods to monitor and surveil innocent people everywhere they go. I mean, it should be said that you could an offense that gets you thrown in an internment camp can be almost anything, including failing to change your name from a Muslim name, failing to shave a long beard, you name it, or even having a family member who's connected to international advocacy or international criticism of China. Radio Free Asia, the Uyghur service that has been doing some great work on this, has a number of American citizens whose entire families have been thrown into these internment camps. There are credible incidental reports of torture. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of people just vanished with no accounting whatsoever. And this is also, it's important to understand the context, part of the Chinese government's larger effort to not only manage the behavior and activity of all of the people inside of its borders, but to snuff out international criticism of the Chinese government around the world. And the way this is done is by forcing not only Uyghurs, but any international Uyghurs or international people who care about the Uyghurs to choose between putting their friends and family at life or death risk or calling out the Chinese government for its bad behavior. Meanwhile, back in the Trump administration, there's a top-level resistance to doing anything substantial to confront China on this for a couple of understandable but unfortunate reasons. The president and the Secretary of State, according to my reporting, are resisting sanctions against China related to human rights because they believe that they need Chinese government help on things like trade and North Korea, and it's another fight that they don't want to pick at this time. Nevertheless, as the atrocities mount and as the evidence of the atrocities mount, international condemnation is mounting and the pressure on governments who profess to care about human rights advocacy is also going up.
Is it too simplistic to say Trump doesn't care about human rights, even though he doesn't care about human rights, and that's the reason the United States is not going to, might not say anything about this kind of oppression in China? I mean, doesn't history suggest that the U.S. gave up decades ago on trying to be serious about pressuring China on human rights when the George H.W. Bush administration kept renewing most favored nation trade status for China despite all the evidence of human rights violations? And then when the Bill Clinton administration made that permanent and they didn't even have to assess China's human rights every year in order to be trading with it at the highest level? I mean, would it be too strong to say the U.S. has given up decades ago on any serious effort to enforce human rights in China?
I mean, I largely agree with you, but I would put it this way. There's been a steady downgrade in human rights advocacy worldwide, and that includes by the United States government, dating back to the end of the Cold War, when human rights was a huge plank of our overall strategic effort to confront the Soviet and fascist threat. And these days, and it started with Clinton, but went on to Bush, but George W. Bush had a freedom agenda that actually rose the priority of human rights advocacy. And then Obama downgraded it again, and now the Trump administration has downgraded it even further. Now, what I can say about President Trump personally is that his human rights advocacy is transactional. It's situational. If you're an enemy country that he doesn't need anything from, North Korea, Iran, Venezuela, well, he's got a human rights finger to wag at you and sanctions and the whole bit. But when it comes to the countries that are either our allies or our partners or those that we're trying to do business with, Saudi Arabia is a great example, or China, well, the administration tends not to support any real action that could make a difference. There are exceptions. There are human rights cases of dissidents. And when those are raised, we do see the Chinese government respond. The wife of Liu Xiaobo, the Nobel Peace Prize winner who died in Chinese detention, was recently allowed to leave after years of harassment and house arrest, mostly because of pressure from the German government, oddly. But, you know, the bottom line here is that there's no doubt that the United States human rights advocacy right now is at a historical low, and it happens not coincidentally to coincide with a backsliding in human rights around the world, as every international organization that reports on these things will tell you. And the only thing we can really say is that as these things get worse, they get harder to ignore. And we've also seen that President Trump has a tendency to change his mind a lot. And when he saw the pictures of Syrian children washing up on shores, he decided to bomb Syria. And then 2 weeks later, he decided, you know, he didn't really want to be involved in Syria at all. So this creates an environment of unpredictability that abusers, especially the Chinese Communist Party, have taken advantage of. And in that unpredictability, they've grossly expanded their repression and challenged the international community to do something about it. So far, their strategy is succeeding.
You said Trump's approach to human rights is transactional, depends whether the country is with us or against us. One could argue that the U.S. policy for 50 years of the Cold War toward human rights was transactional, whether they were with us or against us. But what about Obama in particular? You said that the George W. Bush administration got more concerned about human rights, and the Obama administration actually dialed that back?
Yeah, that's right. And I covered this very closely at the State Department. And, you know, in his second inaugural address, George W. Bush laid out the freedom agenda. Okay, it's a recognition of a segment of our foreign policy community, I would say a union of neoliberals and neoconservatives who, for different reasons and through different means, advocate a policy that combines our interests and our values. To say that human rights advocacy is not just about helping oppressed people abroad, it's about advancing a world that is more conducive to peace, stability, and economic prosperity for that which increases America's national security and economic prosperity. I happen to agree with that. I happen to think that when we do that, and although we do it in an imperfect way, it can both advance the cause of the United States and the cause of these horribly oppressed people. The Obama administration took a different tack, okay? And what they basically did, and this was most obvious when Hillary Clinton made her first trip to China, is they basically took human rights advocacy behind closed doors. And their theory of the case was that they could be more effective with not naming and shaming governments, but rather trying to work with them behind the scenes. I think the data shows that actually is not more effective, that actually you need both private advocacy and public advocacy for human rights in order for it to be have maximum effectiveness. Anyway, that's the strategy they pursued. But now there's not even a real articulation of what our human rights policy is. And a great example was when Secretary of State Mike Pompeo held an entire week of international religious freedom events. Okay, that was only last month. That wasn't that long ago. And he said international religious freedom and universal rights are not just America's cause. They are the God-granted rights, I'm paraphrasing slightly, of all people around the world. Okay, well, that sounds great, but there's a huge gap between that rhetoric and our functional policy, especially when it comes to situations like Tibet and Xinjiang, where we've totally adopted a policy that doesn't reinforce that idea. So it's part of the overall chaos in our foreign policy right now. You said there are two tracks in foreign policy. I see like six or seven, okay? And everyone's got their own track. And Mnuchin has got his track, and Mattis has got his track, and, you know, Bolton's got his track, and the president's got, if on a good day, a track, you know, and Nikki Haley's got her own Mishigas. And what that results in is just utter confusion around the world. And in that unpredictability, it's hard to say that we have any strategic direction. And that's the reality of the situation. So in that chaos, there's also an opportunity where people like Marco Rubio or, you know, Kelly Curry or John Bolton, if they get three or four of these tracks aligned and decide that the situation in Xinjiang is so horrendous that America can't stand idly by, well, something could definitely happen. And you know, that's sort of like the silver lining of the chaos, is that sometimes good things do happen and sometimes you can convince the president to do the right thing. But that's no way to run a railroad, and the Chinese government knows that, and they're changing the facts on the ground all the time. Sure. And keep in mind, they're not just trying to change the situation inside China. They're trying to establish a new international norm on human rights, whereby nobody would be able to tell any sovereign government what to do inside their borders. That's what they want. It's a comprehensive effort. And if they succeed in that, you can imagine that's going to cause or exacerbate the suffering of millions and millions of people as long and as far as the eye can see.
So let's go back to Chris Buckley from the New York Times in Beijing for a closing thought. Chris, I assume you've been hearing Josh Rogan from the Washington Post with that analysis of what's going on in Washington. How much do you think it matters to the fate of these ethnic Uyghur Muslims who are being put in re-education camps by the thousands or the hundreds of thousands? How much do you think it matters to this situation what the Trump administration does?
I did hear part of what Josh was talking about. I dropped out for a little while. I think one important point about understanding the future of this issue is that one of the striking aspects of the international reaction to these mass internments has been the general silence across the Arab world and the Middle East. So, in other words, insofar as there has been an outcry about this issue, it's largely been so far from Western governments, international human rights organizations, not so much from these predominantly Muslim countries that you would think might feel they have a stake in the rights of Uyghurs to practice their religion. Now, the question is that going to change over time, and how is the Chinese government going to respond to that, as well as to any increased pressure from Europe, the United States, and other Western countries? My general feeling is that it's going to take an enormous amount of pressure and consistent pressure for the Chinese government to shift its position on Xinjiang and the future of Uyghurs. Traditionally, the Chinese government has this visceral dislike of any foreign interference, especially when it comes to these areas such as Tibet, such as Xinjiang, which is seen as contentious border areas where Chinese sovereignty is at stake. And I think if this issue becomes increasingly public, then the Trump administration then has to expect the Chinese government is also going to act in that kind of vociferous way as well. I think the other thing to bear in mind is that there are Uyghurs abroad now who are beginning to speak out, but for many of them it's a very difficult process because they feel under threat. They feel that if they speak out, they might be putting family members back in Xinjiang, even in greater danger. So people did speak out for our story and for other reporting that's been done from there, but it requires some courage. And one of the other factors that has to come into play then is what protections are Uyghurs abroad going to be given to ensure that they feel confident speaking out about what they and their families have experienced.
Chris Buckley, China correspondent for the New York Times. Josh Rogan, global opinions columnist who covers foreign policy and national security for the Washington Post. Two great examples of why it's important that journalism is not dead yet. Chris and Josh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.